This is part two in our coverage of the murder of Darren Gray. Please listen to episode one, An Incident in City Park, before continuing with this episode. This series contains discussion of graphic violence, crime scenes, and murder. Listener discretion is advised. This is The Fall Line. Last time, we began on May 8th, 2010. That was the Saturday before Mother's Day. 24-year-old Darren Gray had gone to Lafayette Park, commonly called City Park, in Norfolk, Virginia. It was a place he knew well. His mother, Roycinda Alexander, had taken Darren and his four siblings there throughout their childhoods. They'd grown up in a nearby neighborhood, and Roycinda said that she'd always felt like a part of the community, at least until the events of that Saturday took place. Darren was at the park for a last-minute birthday celebration. Media reports specify it was a child's party, but both court records and Darren's family are more detailed. Both indicate the celebration was for Darren's own son, who had just turned one. Roycinda, Darren's mother, tells us she'd been invited to a party that had been set for the previous weekend, but that one had been canceled. She wasn't aware that this new event was happening. She didn't find out, she tells us, until she got a phone call relaying the news. Darren had been attacked at the park. A group of men, who prosecutors would later allege were members of the Bloods, had been gathered at a picnic pavilion next to the party location. After a brief interaction with Darren, several men had surrounded him and began what authorities described as a, quote, mob-style attack. The Virginian Pilot said that Darren was hit, stomped, and kicked. Darren was hit in the head with a vodka bottle and shot by two separate assailants while dozens of people looked on. Per WAVY News, when authorities arrived, at least 30 people were fleeing from the area. Darren was on the ground. Roycinda Alexander, Darren's mother, was 20 minutes away in Virginia Beach when she heard that her son was killed. She sped back to Norfolk, and when she got to the park, she said that, at first, authorities wouldn't let her through. She said that she remembers getting to the park and seeing her grandson trying to wake up Darren's prone form. She still remembers the photos of the damage that the vodka bottle did to Darren's face. That weekend, Darren's sister, Shantae, was visiting a cousin out of state. She, too, received the news of Darren's murder by phone. A friend called. And being so far away, Shantae felt helpless.
And then I called my mom, I called my sister, I called my brother. I couldn't get in contact with anyone besides the child's mother that was out there that day. And on that line, she kept saying, my baby gone, my baby gone, my baby gone, and just kept crying. And I said, who are you talking about? Then she said, Darren's gone. And that's when her mom took the phone. I would never forget it. Her mom took the phone and was like, don't tell her that. Hang the phone up. And they hung the phone up. And I couldn't reach my mom. And then finally, my cousin got in contact with my mom. And then I was trying to be on any flight back to Norfolk. On the bus, I had to come past City Park. And I looked to it was pitch black. And I looked to the right, and I just bust out crying. And when I got off the bus, I took my son and I held my son, and I waited for my ride. And when I got home, I took my shower, and I just bust out crying in the shower because I didn't want my son to see me crying. But I was very hurt. I was very hurt that someone would even do that to Darren. And in the manner they did it, it was just absurd. I'm just like, what? My brother's gone. My best friend is gone. When Darren first was killed, he came to me in a dream. And I actually did see his murder in my dream. He showed me his murder in my dream. I told my mom about it. That was the first time I really was like, I have some type of closure, but not all the way. I needed that. I feel as though Dern knew I needed that because I wasn't able to get to him right away. So that's what he did. He showed me what happened to him.
Based on news archives, it took approximately 2 days for law enforcement to publicly release Darren's name as the victim of the City Park shooting. When he was identified as the victim on May 10th, the Virginian Pilot reported that the police, quote, still had no details about a motive or information about the shooter. Meanwhile, Darren's family arranged his funeral. The Virginian Pilot reported that the service was held at Park Place Baptist Church and that the space was overflowing with mourners. Per the paper, quote, the family feared more confrontations and violence and hired security to guard the service. After all, Darren had been killed during a child's birthday party at a public park. His family couldn't trust that his funeral would be held as any more sacred. That's where the news coverage ceased in terms of what we can find in the archives. It wouldn't pick up again until 15 months later, when Virginia authorities brought charges against 5 local men. Roysenda hoped that when arrests came, they'd be for Darren's murder. But the case was just more complex. Though 4 men were arrested, they were not accused of Darren's actual homicide. They were charged with his attack. None of the 4 were specified as one of the 2 gunmen who'd ended Darren's life. A 5th man was originally identified as an attacker as well, but per the Virginian Pilot, it was later proven that he was in the hospital on May 8, 2010. Media coverage of the movement in Darren's case came in August of 2011. At that point, it was apparent that the 4 arrests had been made earlier in the year, though we were unable to find archival coverage marking precisely when they occurred. Per the Virginian Pilot, quote, prosecutors presented testimony in court that 10 to 15 people joined in the beating and 2 fired the fatal shots. 4 men were charged with felonies for the mob beating: Lamar Corey, Rashad Jones, Michael Moore, and Centrell Copeland, end quote. According to the Virginian Pilot, there was difficulty securing witnesses willing to testify. A Norfolk prosecutor stated that, quote, witnesses have been threatened. Bottom line. There was only 1 named witness in the coverage of the arrests and court proceedings, a cousin of Darren's, Jamal Dowling, who, per the paper, was reluctant to speak with authorities. When he was arrested on an unrelated charge, the Pilot reported, he finally agreed to discuss Darren's attack. Per the Virginian Pilot, Dowling testified as early as March 2011 at, quote, a preliminary hearing for the co-defendants. It was Dowling who'd originally identified that 5th man, the one who was cleared of involvement due to hospitalization. Per the Pilot, Dowling's testimony involved his own eyewitness account of seeing the attack as he walked through the park toward the party. During court proceedings, the question of motive was a major focus. Why had Darren been attacked? Early reporting in the case cited no clear motive in his beating and murder, but during the court proceedings, the prosecution indicated that the attack and murder were payback for, as the Pilot wrote, quote, a running argument about money and an attempted robbery. Roysenda Alexander believes that Darren did not personally know these men, though prosecutors did indicate otherwise. Rather, Roysenda said that she heard of a few events that might be key to understanding why Darren was targeted. For instance, there was a fight in a barber shop not long before Darren died. And most importantly, Roysenda says another family member had issues with some of the same men who were accused of this attack just shortly before Darren was killed. This is not something we found discussed in the public record, but it's information that has come to Roysenda via a number of different channels. Here's what she told us.
We used to live in Park Place. Darren used to hang out there. They knew Darren's cousin. That's why they say they did it. From what I'm hearing, they was gonna, since they couldn't get the cousin, they decided to get Darren. They were trying to rob his cousin, right? 2 weeks before Darren's death, they pulled into this gas station. It's on film, Commonwealth got it. It's Darren's cousin who is the driver. Darren is sitting in the back seat. The guy pulls a sawed-off shotgun, put in Darren's chest. Darren's cousin pulls his gun out and shoots the guy in the arm, and they pull off. Then, like I say, a week later, Darren is dead.
This might explain why Darren just wasn't on guard when he arrived at the park. He no doubt saw the gathered men, but if he had no direct disagreement with them or didn't recognize them, it's possible that he wouldn't recognize the danger, even if they knew who he was.
Do you think Darren didn't have a full understanding of the danger he was in because he was young and felt like he was invincible?
Yes. How'd you know? You must have met him. That's him. He didn't know because when they sent out word before Darren got killed that they didn't leave no witnesses, Darren still went to that park.
As court proceedings continued through 2011, more details emerged. The Virginian Pilot reported that, of the four accused men, Central Copeland was, quote, tied to the scene by a DNA match from a water bottle cap. That information came from court records. He was the only person to be publicly connected to the scene by DNA. However, he was not identified as a shooter or ever accused of being a shooter by the prosecution. The DNA was used to connect him to the beating attack on Darren. Of the four charged in Darren's beating, he was the first to accept a deal in exchange for a guilty plea. As of August 2011, the other three defendants were, quote, scheduled for trials. Eventually, though, per the Virginian Pilot, Lamar Corey and Rashad Jones declined trial and entered guilty pleas for, quote, malicious wounding by mob. Of the four, Michael Moore was ultimately the only one who went to trial, and he was found guilty of the beating of Darren. The four men's sentences range from 5.5 to 13 years. There were other charges unique to each case, like a probation violation or possession of a controlled substance, that affected their length. But within months of these convictions, there were more headlines concerning Darren's case. His family had expected to hear developments concerning the arrests of Darren's killers, the shooters. But instead, there were perjury charges announced against Jamal Dowling, the state's witness in the case. This information was published in June of 2013. It seems that, as the investigation into Darren's death continued, inconsistencies to Dowling's story were identified. Specifically, the Virginian Pilot reported that, quote, Detective Richard Brady of the Cold Case Unit continued looking into the attack to identify the shooters. He found a problem with Dowling's testimony. The issue came down to Dowling's phone data. The, quote, coordinates of his cell phone calls, they were incompatible with him being an eyewitness to the crime at the park. Based on this information, three of the four convicted men, except for Central Copeland, who was tied to the scene with DNA, sought new hearings. As part of the plea agreement, the Virginian Pilot noted that Copeland, quote, acknowledged taking part in the attack and agreed to several details of the case, including some of the basics that we've outlined here, that the baby was taken from Darren's arms and that Darren was surrounded and beaten by a group of men. Based on what we've put together from public records and limited news reports, Corey, Jones, and Moore all received new hearings. Their sentences were variously reduced or suspended. The ultimate outcome of Dowling's perjury charges ends with a notation of nolle prosequi in the online court system. That's a motion stating that the state declines to prosecute. In Virginia, this amounts to the case being dismissed. However, it still leaves the door open for future possible prosecution. In our research, we did not find any further perjury charges or any further mentions in the media. Roycinda herself does not have any clarity on what was or was not witnessed, and she's gotten conflicting information about that cell phone location data as well. As to the cell phone data, we can't speak to the technology or locations used to raise doubt regarding Dowling's testimony or why the charges were ultimately dismissed. All we know for sure is that at least one of the four men he named was tied to the scene via DNA sample from that bottle cap, and that as late as 2013, prosecutors directly stated that they did not consider the men charged in Darren's beating to be suspects in his shooting. Some things, though, they are certain. There were a number of people in the second pavilion that day, roughly 10. And various reports have estimated that between 5 and 10 men surrounded Darren. His brutal injuries are a fact. The two separate guns, which fired a total of 9 bullets, are a fact. He was murdered. It just comes down to who and how that can be proved. Though no one has given police the information needed to identify the shooters, Roy Senda has long heard the same names, again and again. Though they weren't friends or associates of Darren's, there were some connections. After all, they'd all grown up in the same area. Roy Senda recalled recognizing the name of one person of interest when she first heard it, not long after Darren's death. One thing that bothers her when these names come up are the invariable connections that she finds, the ties to the community.
I don't even think he knew of me, but I knew his mama. You know, they're the same age as my kids. When I heard the name, you know, he's Darren's age now. All of them was around his age. But no, they don't know me. Mm-mm. They probably know me now. I raised my children out there. You know, back then, we still had hold on our kids. You know, my mom had a little hand on me. People can still tell you what to do back then. My kid's cousin helped me with my kids, just like Michael's mother. All of us, you might not knew my name, but yeah, I seen Rosenda before, you know, or something like that. It was real tight-knit out there. Kids went to school with each other. So I just couldn't understand when, like I said, when he got killed, nobody. They talked about it because when they seen me, they would look different. You know, they're shy away. They don't really have too much conversation.
You think they felt guilty?
I do. I have a lady now. We used to be close until I found out my son used to hang around her house. And she never said anything, even after his death. Everybody wanted to tell me stuff when the segment came, you know, but nobody wanted to talk to the police.
That segment Rosenda mentioned was the WAVY news special, which ran last year. The article and accompanying video, they gained traction on YouTube and social media after the story's initial airing, and Rosenda said that more information came in, but mostly it came in to her family. Rosenda has been told that a number of people who were at the party have some knowledge of what happened to Darren that day, not only who jumped him and who fired the guns, but why it all occurred. But she says whether they were directly or indirectly involved or simply witnesses, it's been difficult to convince anyone to just share what they know. She's had to gather more information herself and take it to investigators. But when no one seems willing to talk, how far can it go? We asked Rosenda about her past and current relationship with the investigators on Darren's case.
My son was the reason we have Victim Crime Week. They never had it until Darren got killed because it was the high-profile case and it was the first one here, and they brought all that attention to Virginia. So the mayor came out there for a hot minute, had us build some trees, did some trees at the police station. And that was it. Those trees are dead and gone. They don't even tell me when Crime Victim Week is anymore. For years, I stayed calling them. It was 2 detectives on the case at the time. Detective Smith just came back. But he assured me that before he retires, he's going to do everything he can to make sure Darren's case is solved.
Has there been a reward in Darren's case?
No, and that's what the reporter was telling me. He was like, if you could offer a reward. I said, I don't have money to do nothing like that. I wish I did, or I would have been offered it that day it happened.
Because after all this time, people must have spoken to each other. There must be more than just that immediate group who knows who did it.
Oh, they know. They talk about it on Facebook and codes.
Detective Jonathan Smith, who was originally on Darren's case in 2010, agreed to speak with us about the initial investigation. He's back now on the case and can speak to the difficulty of investigating an incident that took place in a busy public area. Detective Smith also discussed where the case stands today and what it might take to finally identify the shooters.
So, kind of just generically, there's several layers of priority, not only on the first responding officer's level, but the investigator level as well. But, one of the first things that anyone that arrives to a crime scene from the police department's perspective is they want to isolate witnesses. They want to, if there are suspects, they want to isolate the suspects. And they want to obviously start life-saving measures if the person is not deceased, already. And then they want to do their best to try to preserve any kind of crime scene evidence, by way of maintaining those witnesses and, putting up the proverbial yellow crime scene tape around the perimeter just to keep anyone that's not supposed to be inside that crime scene tape out of the crime scene tape. So just kind of in broad brushstrokes, the way to accomplish that is to be very vigilant, aware of their surroundings, try to identify who the suspects are, who the victims are, who the witnesses are, and try their best to corral them and keep them separate so that they're not talking to each other and things like that. At the same time, while they're doing this, they need to be notifying, the dispatcher to have investigators respond and have the crime scene unit respond, and maybe a canine unit if they, get information early on that the suspect may have ran from the scene, things like that.
Brooke spoke with Detective Smith about the difficulty in identifying the shooters and all the men who surrounded Darren in the outdoor scene with so many witnesses about.
Well, every case is different. In this particular instance, I can't tell you that it was common or uncommon. It depends on the various factors, comfort level of the witness to come forward. It depends on what the witness saw or didn't see. So I can't really answer that by saying a hard yes or hard no. It's all really case dependent. And in this particular case, unfortunately, there were not a lot of people that came forward. That could be for a number of different reasons. Maybe they didn't see anything, or maybe they did and they were afraid and didn't want to come forward. I mean, there's just, you could speculate all day long, but unfortunately we didn't have that in this case.
Have you seen rewards be effective in breaking that silence?
I have seen rewards be a compelling factor in cases, but I've also seen cases where rewards have never pushed to nudge someone to come forward.
When we spoke to Roycinda, she expressed surprise and sadness because the family has lived in the community for so long. And, people know her family. She is close to lots of different families and people in the community. What would your department ask of people in the community to help resolve this case?
Well, we would ask anyone that has information on this case to come forward, and they can remain completely anonymous. And when I say completely anonymous, I mean that. And I know the perception is from the public is, well, the police know who we are, even if we call from a blocked number. Well, that's not true. They can call the crime line, and their number is completely blocked. The crime line person does not even know who's calling. They can also text in the tips now anonymously. So we would ask that anyone that has information on this case to please come forward and share what they have, even if it's just something that they've heard. That's fine as well. And of course, any eyewitnesses that may be out there that come forward, we would love to talk to them, and we can even text back and forth. They don't have to identify themselves.
The issue of rewards comes up a lot on this show. For instance, in the Chido Garibay case, a $50,000 reward had been in place for more than 10 years without the money leading to an arrest. But from what we've learned, you simply don't know how effective reward money will be until it's offered. though there is a $1,000 Crime Stoppers reward that can be claimed if an arrest is made in Darren's homicide case, that doesn't tell us much. Could $10,000 or $20,000 make a difference? Would someone finally be willing to speak? Roycinda and her children have often wondered what it will take to push someone with the right information to come forward. They understand the fear of reprisal and why people don't want to speak with law enforcement, but they're looking at it from this perspective, that Darren Gray was a member of the community. They want that to mean that the same community will gather around him, even a decade later. Miguel, Darren's youngest brother, spoke with us about that frustration.
Like I mentioned, we grew up in that neighborhood. It was people out there that we knew. He was at his son's birthday party. There's a lot of people who could say something, who know somebody of that nature or something. But yeah, they don't want to talk. Nobody wants to say anything. It has to be a great witness intimidation going on because nobody want to say anything. Even mother, like, she was standing right there. I don't know. Somebody seen something. It was broad daylight. Like, I don't get it. It's been hard and definitely hard on my mother. It's like our family just went cold. Everybody just cold. We don't like to really even speak about the death. It just, everybody's moved on, but it's like a hole in the family.
So is there anything else that you would want our listeners to know about Darren and about your family?
Yes, like just to ask to put themselves in our shoes. Our brother was brutally murdered at his son's birthday party, like, in broad daylight, and we can't get one witness to come forward and tell us what happened, like, seen anybody. He was stabbed, shot, executed. We just want answers, any answers. That's all we want. Closure for the whole family. He was a good guy, family man, brother, uncle, this, that, and the third. And we just want justice for him. That's it.
That's something Shantae, Darren's sister, has returned to as well, wanting not only Norfolk residents, but anyone listening, to understand what it's been like for their mother and how the loss of a family member, especially to violence, reverberates.
It destroyed my mom. Darren's death took her to a dark place.
What was she like before?
My mom was funny. She was friendly. She was very friendly because she was also a people person. That's where Darren got it from. She was a bright person. Even if you did wrong, she saw good in you. Even if you did the worst thing possible, she still sees the good in you. And I say that to this day because things I go through in my relationship with my ex, my mom still never talks bad about him. And still sees the good in him. And that's what I love about my mom. She's not judgmental. When she can be judgmental, she's still not judgmental.
Was Darren that way at all?
He was. Darren was very forgiving. Like, you can do the craziest thing to Darren, and the next day, he's smiling and joking with you. Like, nothing happened that prior day. And that's what made me so mad when I received that call. Because I'm like, how could you kill such a genuine person? To this day, I still don't understand that.
It sounds like so many people might be aware of what happened. And with like one phone call could potentially change the case.
Right. Yes, because that's why we have media, to get things out there. So people can come forward. That's why we have all these platforms. They're supposed to use these platforms to get answers. But it's just like, oh, we have these platforms, so what? I feel like because it's not a high profile case, it's not really important. Because, like I said, if it was a high profile case, oh, this case would have been solved.
Shante's point that platforms are not enough is important. It takes more than media attention to close a case. The precise combination may be different depending on the circumstances, but active investigation, sustained media attention, and community involvement are all key. Engaging all three is the best chance that a cold case has. Shante says that her perspective on the world has changed in a lot of ways, as a mother and a sister, but also in terms of focus.
I don't understand it. I don't understand. People should understand that once a person dies, they're never coming back. And then to take a person before their time is really crazy. But you have a lot of sick people in this world. And I was always told, it's not for you to understand. What people do is not for you to understand. I just want people to understand that death is final. So you need to make peace with your loved ones, and you need to be a part of every person's upbringing, whether it's your siblings, your cousins, your children, your grandparents, because once they're gone, memories are all you have. And when you get older, memories start to fade. So right now, love on your loved ones.
We've featured many mothers of missing and murdered children on the Fall Line, and each of them has discussed how loss has impacted their lives. Grief affects them individually, and it reshapes their families. Roysinda spoke with us about the impact of Darren's loss. She says that part of that impact is that she's still waiting.
Right now, it's just me and my significant other, because me and my husband are still married, but we're separated. I don't know if you know, if you have ever lost anyone, but that's one thing that goes, is it does break up a happy home. So, yeah, because I had the perfect marriage, all of that. I was wondering why he wasn't grieving, but he was, you know, just in his own little way, but it was just me. So I left the home to allow him to go on with his life because, like I say, he raised my kids, and he didn't have any kids of his own. So I said, I'll just leave and seek justice for my son, Darren, and his brother. So, and that's what I did. And we still talk and stuff. We just don't live together.
That's where Roysinda has put her energy over the last decade, into advocacy. As she did when her son Sergio experienced lead poisoning and she had to fight for him in the school system, she's gone on to fight for Darren too. She's also sought out support from the only people who can understand what she's experienced, other parents of murdered children. When she goes to conferences or works on reform and local action, it's all in the name of Darren. She celebrates resolution in the cases of other families, and she waits for her own. When she moved to Arkansas for one of her husband's Navy assignments, she was active in support groups there as well. It led to Darren being recognized in an official ceremony there, something that she would love to see back in Virginia.
I'm going to be in Atlanta for a Parents of Murdered Children conference in July. I got Darren on the Parents of Murdered Children. I got him a board. You know, he's on one of those boards. And I still stay in contact with them. They're one of my best friends, too. They helped me during that time, finish school, when I was down there in Arkansas. You have to find a support group. You can't do it by yourself.
The group Roysinda mentioned, Parents of Murdered Children, is a large and active organization that other parents we featured have found helpful and supportive. We'll include a link to their website in our show notes. As Roysinda mentioned, she appreciates that Darren's face has been featured on the organization's boards and on a plaque. Now she needs him back in the headlines, in Norfolk. And more than anything, Roysinda wants to see her son's case resolved. She knows that with so many possible witnesses, there is someone out there who can make the call. Back in 2011, the year after Darren's murder, Roysinda spoke with a Virginian pilot. She told reporters of her son, shot down in City Park at a child's party. Quote, he didn't have to die like that. Roy Senda watched her own son grow up from baby to child to young man, but Darren didn't have that chance. For Roy Senda, the month of May remains hard. Some years, Mother's Day actually falls on the anniversary of Darren's death. It's always close. Now, with the 13th anniversary of her son's murder on the horizon, Roy Senda Alexander is tired. Tired of rumors and quiet answers. She wants the truth out in the open for Darren's sake. If you have any information regarding the murder of Darren Anthony Gray, you can call the crime line at 1-888-562-5887 or visit p3tips.com. Tips leading to an arrest are eligible for a reward of up to $1,000. If you know of a case that should be covered on the fall line, there's a link to our case submission form in the show notes. Thank you for listening. The Fall Line is an independently produced show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIA, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us on Patreon. We're raising Patreon funds to continue to pay for the Milberg Twins billboard and to fund therapy for families who've been on the show. Each and every one of our patrons helps us to continue to do this work, and we're so grateful. On Patreon, you can get early release ad-free versions of our regular episodes for $5 a month. We also have other occasional bonus material starting at just $1. If you prefer Apple Premium, we've begun that feed as well, so you have another way to contribute. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters, Kiana Burgess, and Michaela Morrow. Interviews by Brooke Hargrove, produced, engineered, and scored by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And, as always, our most special thanks to Angie Dodd, Liz Lipka, and Sarah Turney. As of November 2022, monthly donations are going to Season of Justice to support their testing and family grant initiatives.